When I was a campus minister at Drexel, the university published a literary journal. I forget the name now. In fact, I'm not sure it even exists anymore. But I remember that each issue was organized around a specific theme. And I remember one in particular focused on the theme of temptation. To promote the issue, they decided to host a public panel discussion of the theme. It was a wine and cheese kind of event, not exactly my scene. It was held at First Unitarian Church in Center City, and it featured panelists representing several notable temptations. As I recall, there was a pastry chef, a burlesque performer, a recovering addict and alcoholic, and I want to say someone, I can't remember exactly, having something to do with greed, maybe a recovering gambling addict. I guess, you know, they couldn't find a wealthy CEO to participate in the panel. Anyway, it was all people who either invited temptation in one form or another, or had given into it themselves. And then there was yours truly, representing apparently religion and spirituality as the antidote to temptation and sin, the good trying desperately to resist the bad. And I was, if you're keeping track of the math, outnumbered 4-1 on the panel, as if to visualize in that space how hard it can be to resist temptation. 4-1. I'm not really built for panel discussions and spontaneous articulation, but I agreed to do it anyway because I was relatively new in my role at Drexel, and I figured it would be a unique way to put myself and the ministry we were trying to build out there in the campus community and the wider community. It felt like a cool thing to do, at least a cool thing to be able to say I did, or to someday preach about, perhaps. And I thought it might be kind of fun. In truth, it was more awkward than fun for me. I don't remember anything about what was said. After a general question or two from the moderator, the discussion opened up to the audience, and as probably will not surprise you, almost all of the questions went to the temptation side of the panel, the fun side, which was probably just as well. When I did have the chance to speak, I remember trying to make the point that temptation comes in all shapes and sizes, trying to broaden an understanding of temptation beyond just the dictionary definition, to do something we're not supposed to do, something wrong or something bad. Thinking of temptation more as settling, as a perceived shortcut to what we most deeply need, to what we most deeply desire. A surface level, short-sighted, short-lived, sometimes immediate fix, fleeting pleasure often coming at the expense of overall well-being and wholeness. And I remember trying to broaden an understanding of temptation beyond just the individual level that we think about and that the panel was focused around. I think I mentioned something about capital punishment, the death penalty, as an example of the kind of collective social temptation that settles for vengeance as a substitute for justice, retribution as a substitute for restoration. Because, let's be honest, that's easier. And at some level, it's satisfying as a response to violence. Anyway, that's what I remember trying to do. After the discussion, I can tell you that not one single person came up to talk to me after. The party was clearly elsewhere in the room, an introvert that I am. I was okay with that. So I stuck around long enough to grab some free food and drink and left. And I haven't done a panel discussion since, and I'm okay with that. Having revisited Jesus's dramatic transfiguration last week, we rewind in Luke's gospel as we lean into Lent from transfiguration to temptation, from mountaintop to wilderness. The story of Jesus's temptation in the wilderness is described like so many stories in all three synoptic gospels, but not in John. Matthew and Luke are more or less the same. Curiously, the account in Mark is short and sweet, just two sentences. And the Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness for 40 days, tempted by Satan, and he was with the wild beasts, and the angels waited on him. End of story in Mark. For the authors of Matthew and Luke, the story carries much more significance. And within our ongoing liturgical flow, Jesus' 40-day temptation in the wilderness provides the narrative start to the 40-day Lenten journey. So with this story, we're reminded again of Moses and Elijah, right, who were there with Jesus on the mountaintop, both of whom had their own 40-day spiritual journeys. And we're reminded of the Israelites' 40-year journey through the wilderness before reaching the promised land. We're told in Luke that Jesus is full of the Holy Spirit, having just returned from the Jordan River, and his Spirit-filled baptism. In Luke's version, he's led by that same Spirit in the wilderness, where he's tempted by the devil. The translation in Matthew's version says he's led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. It's not a difference in translation. The original Greek is curiously different between Luke and Matthew. And maybe a minor detail, but worth noting, I think, especially considering the theological implications of an understanding of God on one hand as with us in the wilderness, and on the other hand, as deliberately, actively leading us into the wilderness, into temptation, so that we might be tested. And common as that latter understanding of God is within the Christian church, personally, I find it hard to take. I don't buy it. And Lord knows life is test enough all by itself. In any case, it's the devil, Satan, Satan, in the Greek, the adversary, the personification of evil, who does the tempting in the story. It's the devil, like the serpent in Genesis, who represents the capacity within each of us to make choices based on false promises, whether those promises come from external or internal voices. There are three tests, the classic formula, the same three tests in Matthew and Luke, just presented in different order. Jesus, again, is fasting, and so he is famished. Not surprisingly, then, the devil shows up in the story exactly at that point, when Jesus is most vulnerable, as temptation, right, often does, when we are most vulnerable physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Because again, what is temptation but a settling, a perceived shortcut to what we most deeply need and what we most deeply desire? A surface level, short-sighted, short-lived, sometimes immediate fix, an easy, fleeting pleasure, often coming at the expense of our overall well-being and wholeness. So the devil approaches a hungry Jesus with the promise of food. If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread. Surely the Jesus who could turn water into wine can turn a stone into bread, right? Delicious, mouth-watering bread. What would be the harm in that when he is so clearly hungry? But that's not the point. That's not the temptation. He's not resisting the temptation to eat, satisfying as that would be. He's resisting the temptation to prove himself, to prove his power. It is written, he says, quoting from Deuteronomy and Mosaic law, referencing the story of holy manna raining down from heaven to the hungry Israelites. One does not live by bread alone. And the text he's quoting goes on, though he does not, at least in Luke's version, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. One does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Who are you to tell me what I need? Jesus says. Jesus knows what he needs. Jesus knows who he is, and Jesus knows whose he is. Again, remember that just before this story of Jesus' baptism, during which the voice of God, the same voice we heard at the scene of mountaintop transfiguration, affirms Jesus as my beloved son. Same voice, same message. Jesus is God's beloved, and when you are so beloved and know that you are so beloved, you do not have to prove yourself to anyone, ever. As Jan Richardson writes, if we back up a bit in Luke, we will be able to enter this week's text with the same knowledge that Jesus had, that when he went into the desert, he went with the baptismal waters of the Jordan still clinging to him, and with the name Beloved ringing in his ears. How else to enter into the 40-day place that lay ahead of him? How else to cross into the wilderness where he would have no food, no community, nothing that was familiar to him, and to top it off, would have to wrestle with the devil? How else, she concludes, but to go into that landscape with the knowledge of his own name, Beloved. Jesus is firmly grounded in who he is and whose he is as God's beloved. He responds to the devil's temptation and makes his choice from that deeper place with a longer view. And in so doing, he maintains his divine center. And so the devil, again, as temptation does, persists. He tries a different approach to throw Jesus off his center. In an instant, as the text describes it, the devil shows him all the kingdoms of the world and promises authority over them if Jesus will worship him. Again, quoting from Deuteronomy, Jesus remains grounded in his response. Worship the Lord your God and serve only God. God has already given me everything I need, he responds. Jesus does from a deeper place with a longer view. He maintains his divine center. And undeterred, the devil takes him to the pinnacle of the temple for the third and final test. If you are the Son of God, again, Son of God, if you throw yourself down from here, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. The devil ups his game with some Bible quoting of his own, setting Jesus up with a taste of his own medicine. From the psalm we heard this morning, God will command God's angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. To which Jesus responds, dropping yet more Mosaic law from Deuteronomy, it is said, do not put the Lord your God to the test. God does not need to prove God's self. I am who I am. Remember, I will be what I will be. And Jesus does not need to prove himself. He knows who he is. He knows whose he is. He responds from a deeper place with a longer view. He maintains his divine center. And with that, the devil departs until an opportune time. Because, you know, that's also how temptation works. When we are vulnerable in mind and body or spirit, too far removed from who and whose we are as God's beloved, we are tempted to shortcut our own needs, to pay attention to other voices, to pay heed to other gods, short-sighted, superficial, here today, gone tomorrow, gods. In the wilderness, Jesus gives us a glimpse of what it looks like to live holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, grounded, centered in his identity as God's beloved, and therefore holy, H-O-L-Y. It is not about being good or bad. It's not about doing the wrong thing or not making the wrong choice or not being sinful. It's about being whole, prioritizing wholeness for ourselves and for each other. As Parker Palmer suggests, when we understand integrity for what it is, we stop obsessing over codes of conduct and embark on the more demanding journey toward being whole. Then we learn the truth of John Middleton Murray's remark, for the good person to realize that it is better to be whole than to be good is to enter on a straight and narrow path compared to which their previous rectitude was flowery license. Wholeness. Wholeness comes to us when we are fully grounded in who and whose we are, even in and through the very real brokenness of our lives and of the world around us. It comes when we listen for and pay attention to the divine presence within us, the voice of God that speaks to our deepest needs and our deepest longings. We are broken people in a broken world. We know wilderness within, and we know wilderness all around, but we are also beloved people living in a beautiful world. People made in the divine image, made by love, for wholeness. In that spirit, let me close as I did last week with another blessing from Jan Richardson. If you would enter into the wilderness, do not begin without a blessing. Do not leave without hearing who you are, beloved, named by the one who has traveled this path before you. Do not go without letting it echo in your ears. And if you find it is hard to let it into your heart, do not despair. That is what the journey is for. I cannot promise this blessing will free you from danger, from fear, from hunger or thirst, from the scorching of sun or the fall of the night, but I can tell you that on this path there will be help. I can tell you that on this way there will be rest. I can tell you that you will know the strange graces that come to our aid only on a road such as this, that fly to meet us bearing comfort and strength, that come alongside us for no other cause than to lean themselves toward our ear and with their curious insistence whisper our name. Beloved, beloved, beloved. Friends, may your journey with Jesus through the wilderness landscape of Lent be a gracious reminder always, right? We can't hear that reminder enough that you are God's beloved before you are anything else. You have nothing to prove. And may that truth sink in deep down, and may it keep you on your divine center. May it be so.